Not much.
Much? Not much.
Oh. Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 1 minute after 9 a.m., January 27, 2011. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and Senator McGuire. I should mention, normally the my co-chair handles operating, all the operating items, but there's a frog going around on grabbing voices, so I'm standing in for him yesterday and today. Today we've invited Mr. David Teal, the Director of Legislative Finance, to present the outlook for the state revenue and spending. And I'd like to invite him forward, if he could, and he knows the drill. He's been through it numerous times. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Teal, Legislative Finance Division Director. And this morning, you'd asked me to talk about just an overview of Alaska's fiscal situation. Typically, the fiscal summary is a starting point for those discussions, and depending on your perspective, that fiscal summary is either the high-level short version of the state budget, or it's so many numbers crammed on a page that it's hard to figure out what's important, and it's hard to read just physically.
If you could just pause for a minute, I just want to mention it. I had a conversation with Mr. Teal yesterday on the presentation and the format. I was hoping that we would have this televised, so I'd asked him to include some of the basic stuff that may be a little redundant for us here at the table, but for the audience at home, so they could help with the following along of the budget process here. So there might be some stuff in the presentation that wouldn't have normally been in there, because obviously we can see the camera is not here today, and most of the public that is here is well tuned with what's going on. So just thought I'd mention that, Mr. Teal. If we go ahead and continue.
And the review probably doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Because of the budget clarification project last year, there were some redefinitions of revenue and expenditures. So it's the first few slides here are, or maybe, review for many of the committee members. So turning to the presentation itself, four elements of budgeting: revenue, appropriations, balances, and the long-term plan. For years, we've known that revenue is part of the picture here, but there were persistent deficits, and because there were persistent deficits, the legislature tended to spend what it believed it was necessary to spend, and that was typically beyond the amount of money that was available. So revenue wasn't really part of the discussion. We simply spent what we needed and withdrew the deficit or fiscal gap from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And with the high oil prices beginning in fiscal year 05, and later with the change in oil taxes, revenue climbed substantially, and revenue became an important part of the discussions, partly because there was a desire to have a balanced budget, finally, and second, because you wanted to repay some of the borrowings from the Constitutional Budget Reserve and set up other reserve accounts in anticipation of return or potential return to deficits. So reserves became an important topic as well. And then the question, of course, comes up, what are those reserves for? How long will they last? And that's the long-term plan portion of this this presentation this morning. In the revenue sources book, which is published twice a year, they provide the information that was used to produce this chart. It shows $13 billion in total revenue, and splits it into oil, non-oil, federal, and investment money. It's all accurate and interesting, but not perhaps particularly useful to you because you don't appropriate all the money that's shown here. For example, in investment revenue, much of that is permanent fund earnings. Half a billion of it is constitutional budget reserve earnings. So you really have about $500 million a year, not $3.5 billion a year, that you're appropriating from investment earnings. Similarly, oil. 25% of oil revenue goes to the permanent fund. It's dedicated. You don't appropriate that money. So perhaps more significantly, oil money spends exactly the same way as other tax revenue or as investment revenue does. So rather than categorize revenue by source in this way, we categorize it according to the amount of discretion that the legislature has in spending it. And by doing that, we're able to put revenue and appropriations in the same category. In other words, unrestricted general funds is both a way to talk about revenue and it's a way to talk about appropriations. So the distinction between unrestricted general funds, or UGF, and designated general funds is something that was new last year. Other state revenue is an old title but is now recategorized, and federal receipts is much the same as it used to be. So the federal receipts typically have strings attached. You have very little discretion in how you spend them. Often there's a match requirement, and they're split pretty evenly between mostly capital, mostly transportation projects in the capital budget, then the formula programs like Medicaid, and some agencies, particularly Military Veterans Affairs, Labor, and Education, have a substantial amount of federal money in their operating budgets. Other state funds is the one that were the category that was most affected by the budget clarification project. That used to be almost $3 billion. And with the redefinitions, it's now about $500 million. You have very little discretion in spending these other revenues. They are, as the slide shows, international airports, state corporations, trusts, and dedicated revenues. So that money is strongly restricted so that it must be spent in the way or for the purposes for which it was generated. And the discretion here applies to where it's spent in general. For instance, Fish and Game Fund. You have to spend Fish and Game Fund on fish and game projects, but that doesn't tell you that you have to do a dull sheep count in the Brooks Range as opposed to something else in Southeast Alaska. So it's a more general rather than specific funding limitations. Designated general funds are still general funds. They've simply been designated, and I want to emphasize designated, not dedicated, for a specific purpose in statute. University receipts, marine highway receipts, all these other fees for services that agencies charge are designated general funds, or DGF. The legislature doesn't have to, but typically does follow the statutory guidelines for designated general funds. Unrestricted general funds, of course, is the one where you have the most discretion. It's unlimited, in fact. So 88% of that general UGF revenue is oil revenue, and it is typically referenced as state spending by the press, by the legislature, and that makes sense because it's the UGF that determines the fiscal gap or fiscal surplus. And this is why the governor, in his December 15th release of the budget, focused on agency operations, saying that that is the small portion of the budget that he has control over. Just a last point on this is that your discretion is actually more limited than this slide implies, and that's because formula programs limit this. You must spend money on K-12 and Medicaid formula, which is almost half of the unrestricted general funds, so that when I say you have complete discretion, you do, other than the fact that you follow formula funding rules. So when presented in that way, or in this new categorization, the amount of revenue that we're talking about drops from $13.3 billion to $9.9 billion. And again, here's the pie chart. You can see for yourself which pieces go. But we don't show the permanent fund on this. We could, because those earnings from the permanent fund are spendable. But for political reasons, they generally are considered not spendable, and we don't want to include them as revenue, because then you would always be showing a surplus, because if it would show, it would increase your revenue, but you wouldn't appropriate them. And these categories line up with the fiscal summary. And with that background, I hope the fiscal summary makes a little more sense. Note that the categories are unrestricted general funds, designated general funds, and then we go to the other and federal, and there's your total. Also note that there are four sections: revenue, and operating appropriations, statewide operating appropriations, and capital appropriations. There's no need to compare this with the OMB fiscal summary that was released on December 15th. There were some errors in preparation of that. I think they'll be fixed when OMB releases a revised fiscal summary, when the governor's amendments come out. And we're actually very close to the OMB, and ledge finance fiscal summaries are very close. So there's also no need to go through this line by line, because there are only a few key points that you probably wanted to get out of this at an overview presentation like this. Those points are that revenue is up by $328 million. However, spending is up by $400 million, and this is general funds. That $400 million consists of $167 million in the agency operating budgets, $121 million in statewide operating budgets, and $112 million in the capital budget. There's a cash flow deficit of $25 million.
You want to point that out, line 36?
Yeah, the arrow keeps disappearing on me, but it's there on line 36. There's a cash flow deficit of $26 million. And perhaps I should emphasize here, based on the article in the paper yesterday, that this is a cash flow deficit. The governor then withdraws $310 million from savings accounts to give a surplus on line 47 of $284 million. You can look at that was for FY12. You can look at FY11, the same sorts of numbers, and there you'll see there's a deficit of $14 million. That deficit is obviously a question mark, as is the FY12 numbers, simply because we have a lot better handle on what we spend than we do on the amount of revenue coming in. So those key points, which of them should concern you? The revenue increase is all good news. That's if oil prices and production are as they're projected to be. On this, the revenue is based on a price of $83 per barrel. That seems reasonable given where prices are right now. The year-to-date, it's actually about even equal to the year-to-date price for FY11. But the Department of Revenue says that production will be up by 1% in FY12. Typically, it's down about 4% to 6% per year. So that $300 million million of additional revenue shown on the fiscal summary might be wishful thinking. We have no way of knowing that yet. Depends on whether the production forecasts hold and where price is. The second, $400 million higher. Well, we know that the governor omitted $120 million of Medicaid spending from his budget. That could just as easily be $520 million increase in spending. And what about K-12? The governor submitted no increase in K-12. We know that school districts will be here soon telling you that they need a substantial increase in funding. The legislature typically increases the budget, particularly the capital budget. So I would say that it's not just possible, it's likely that the final appropriations will be higher than what the governor submitted.
Point. Mr. Gio, could you, before you jump to the next slide, is that what you were going to do?
No, I was going to say that the $25 million is insignificant. That's the equivalent of trying to predict oil prices to within 25 cents, effectively. And the $310 million removed from savings account, I just find somewhat puzzling. The legislature considered this last year because the governor submitted a similar proposal. What's puzzling to me is that the $310 million withdrawn leaves you with a surplus of $284 million. If that's the case, you have to ask, where would the surplus go at the end of the year? And it simply would normally fall into a reserve account. Well, if his purpose is to consolidate the reserve accounts, because what he's doing is taking money from the AHFC savings account that the legislature established in 2007, but not withdrawing all of it, and presumably this transfer would simply be a transfer from the AHFC savings account into the statutory budget reserve account. You can do that with an appropriation from one savings account to the other if the idea is simply to consolidate reserves. So I don't know that the House is any more cynical than you are, but in this presentation to the Finance Committee on that side, the point was raised, well, why would you want to make the surplus appear larger than the cash flow analysis gives you? And that's not for me to say. It's unless they were looking at ulterior motives and saying, well, what possible reason could there be for making the deficit or the surplus appear larger than cash flow supports, and taking that to a change in the oil tax legislation. But and the last point here, the FY11 surplus, that is significant to you because you usually spend a substantial amount of any remaining surplus on supplemental capital appropriations. And at the moment, it appears that there is no money to spend. But we don't know that. At current prices, the surplus in 11 would be about $600 million if they last through the end of the year. At the same time, there was a pipeline shutdown, which cost us about $100 million. We don't know where prices are going to be, but we do have time here as we get closer to the end of the fiscal year to determine how much is available to save or spend in the supplemental budget process.
And Mr. Steele, maybe before you go on to the next slide.
Okay.
Yesterday we spent some time looking out into the future on a projected forecast, but I see there was, or as I recall, there was a lot of conversation on the growth of the agency operations, which is line 8, and that showing it on the fiscal summary anyway, at 3.8, or even on your slide here, I think you've got it up, 3.8%, the agency operations up $167 million. And there's been a lot of concentration on that number. But then when we look at statewide, it's 11.5, and you put them together, and it ends up being 5.2. So should we as a committee just pay attention to the 3.8 and not worry about statewide and only the portion that we have control of, or is the things that we don't have control of concern of ours?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would pay attention to the whole thing, because the agency operations are the amount that one could argue is you have most control over there. Over, you certainly have control over those other items. And we'll get to that in a minute. Those other items include retirement spending, for instance. Statewide debt. You, by issuing GO bonds, you affect future statewide spending. So you definitely control that. The control is not as immediate as it is for agency operations, but it's certainly in your control, and those numbers tend to be larger. And we're talking multi-hundreds of millions of dollars in the statewide versus agency operations that are difficult to take that much money out of operations.
So then, just as a follow-up on that, so we're looking at 5.2, which is reflected on, well, down in the fiscal summary, the fiscal summary, listed as page 11, down on the lower right-hand side, mm-hmm. The total 5.2. I think yesterday we were using 3% going forward as a forecast number. Some of the questions that we were looking at yesterday was, is the 3% expectation going forward, how reasonable is that? And then if you change that number, say, to 2% or 4%, what's the impact, or 6%? And I don't know if you have it later on in your slides, but if you don't, maybe you can get back to the committee on what that growth factor has been over the last several years. And we've asked that with OMB, and I don't know if you want to get with OMB so we get some agreement on those numbers, and you want to come forward with them or what. And I also recognize there might be some challenges with the restating of the general funds, but the top line number of 5.2, we should be able to get a hold of that, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there are some slides later on here that will address all of those points.
Okay. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a minor point. I assume, but I guess I should ask it, is does the surplus calculations incorporate the fiscal year, in fiscal year 11, incorporate the vetoes, the governor's vetoes on the capital budget?
Through the chair, yes, they do, Senator Thomas.
They
do not incorporate any supplementals that are coming.
Right.
And, you know, we typically don't reproduce a full fiscal summary until the end of session, but we do keep an abbreviated version of it, and generally the chairman tracks that pretty closely.
Thank you.
So the fiscal summary is just a cash flow statement. There's no balance information on it, and since a revenue stream is volatile, it's often nice to know how much we have in reserves. And the short answer there is that we've got reserves like nobody else. As you may know, most other states are in a severe deficit situation, trying to figure out what to cut, how to delay expenditures, furloughs, any number of efforts to survive what the effects of the recession. At the same time that they've experienced some really tough times, we've built reserves. And
Mr. Chair, before you jump to that slide, could you just, that 14, I know we've used, could you give us, is that a projection for end of FY12, or and what's a rough composition between on that between the statutory and the constitutional budget reserves and then other funds that may be laying around?
Okay. On that, the $14 billion on slide 14.
13.
I'm on 14 because it's easier to answer the questions if you look at slide 14.
Okay. My headache again. I'm sorry about that.
It's quite all right. You can see that we started FY11 with about $13.7 billion in reserves. They've grown. Now, excluding the permanent fund, which cannot be spent, I'm looking at $14 billion in reserves. A number of people use different numbers for this, and I can explain why. Some of it's difficult to access. The permanent fund earnings reserve account for political reasons, the constitutional budget reserve at $9.7 billion at the end of 11 because of a three-quarter vote. And then you've got some that would simply increase spending if we were to pull that money from reserves. Those include things like the power cost equalization endowment and the revenue sharing fund. And some are not considered savings by some people. That would be the public education fund, where you got $1.2 billion in there. And because it's only forward funding, they say it's not true savings. But the fact is that under forward funding, you always have $1 billion sitting there. But it's not important. The number that is important is that we've got something on the order of two times our annual budget sitting in reserves. Other states consider themselves to have huge reserves if they're at 5% of their budget. So, as I said, we have reserves like no other state. And even if you debate that some of these are inaccessible or undesirable spending, in the SBR and in the Alaska Capital Housing, which no one could argue that those are just pure cash reserves, that's $1.5 billion. And unless we dip into them, those reserves will exceed $15 billion by the end of FY12.
So, and I can't remember what state it was, but I know most of the states measure this numeric in months, not years. And some of them I've heard on in the news with their tight budgetary issues, they have, you know, a couple months of liquidity out in front of them instead of a couple of years. Have you seen stuff in your trade journals on?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they would never even think to measure reserves in years. They're looking at liquidity needs. And by that, it's strictly a matter of essentially when is the state bankrupt? When can we not pay our bills? And they're looking at a matter of months. This is looking at if we have no revenue whatsoever, the pipeline shuts down, we stop collecting fees, taxes, and everything else, we last for 2 years. It seems like just an incredible amount of money to any other state, which, as you say, looks at reserves as being, you know, maybe something on the order of $10 million sitting in a rainy day fund. But, you know, in their opinion, they wouldn't need the reserves because they believed that their revenue sources were less volatile. I think the recession proved the wisdom of having reserves.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just back to the the idea of the forward-funded education money. You still consider it a reserve, even though it may be obligated or designated, because it's money in an account someplace, and until it's expended, then you would not consider it. You would not remove it from that categorization anyhow, I guess.
Through the chair, what happens there is we, let's just call it an even $1 billion. Yeah. We put in $1 billion every year for the following year, and we pull out $1 billion for the current year. The balance remains at $1 billion. So that once that $1 billion is sitting there, you could just as well say we're appropriating money not into the fund but directly to K-12. If we chose to look at it that way, you would have a $1 billion reserve account. The fact that money flows in and flows out doesn't change the fact that you cut $1 billion sitting there all the time.
Yeah. Thank you.
So again, the value of reserves is to provide that level of comfort for the longer term, giving us time to react if oil prices fall or production falls. It also provides breathing room for FY12 or any current year. And the question would be, how much breathing room? And that's a question that's equivalent to saying, how accurate is the revenue forecast? We don't know how accurate it is. We don't like a single point forecast. The Department of Revenue says oil will be $77.96 or something like that, and tells you that this is how much revenue you'll have. And of course, the questions we get at Ledge Finance are, well, we're not at $77.96. What's the surplus going to be? What's the deficit going to be? Prices are low, that sort of thing. So we prefer a sensitivity chart approach to that. And this one's for 11. The following chart is for 12. But they're the same. Let me explain how to read this. The axis here is in billions of dollars. And you're reading both expenditures and revenue on this axis.
And that includes the capital budget on your expenditures. Go over the operating and the capital issue, if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, it does. It's unrestricted general fund expenditures in all categories. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have to do some estimating on that for the revenue curve, but the expenditure curve is right off the fiscal summary. So the expenditure line would just be flat. And that's because the x-axis here is price of oil. And expenditures are simply a number that does not depend on the price of oil. So if you appropriate, as you did, about $5.35 billion, then that money's gone, whether oil's at $90 or $50. The revenue curve, however, is not flat. At low prices, we have less revenue. At high prices, revenue goes up. And it's a curve because we have a progressive tax scheme. So that, as a rule of thumb, we say a $1 change in the price of oil generates $100 million. Actually, at the low end, it's closer to 70, and at the high end, it's 120 to 150 million, depending on where you are in the curve. So, you can see that if you wanted to know what would happen if oil were at $70 for the year, all you have to do is go to the $70, read up and say, well, expenditures are still here at 5.3, revenue is low. And you could read it as this gap or, as we show it, a deficit here. So $70 should give you a deficit somewhere around $800 million. Similarly, the fiscal year-to-date average price is about $82. At $82, you would have a $600 million surplus. And this is the number I was quoting earlier, but of course it doesn't include the pipeline shutdown. But it gives us a break-even price of oil. And that break-even price is simply where the revenue curve and expenditure curve cross. and that break-even point is about $77 for FY11. There's a similar chart for FY12. And with the FY12, we see that it looks very much the same, but note that the expenditure curve has shifted up from 5.3 to 5.7, $5.8 billion. And that you can't see it, but the revenue curve has shifted downward, and the break-even price is $83. So at that price, there's a small deficit, $25 million, that you saw in the fiscal summary.
Mr. Teal, do you have a question?
Yep.
Senator Hoffman.
Just a request, I guess, Mr. Chairman. Could Mr. Teal provide us a chart for FY12 with the parameters that the governor has submitted to us for his new tax structure? And obviously the slope is going to go down, but it would be interesting to see how that would impact the break-even point for FY12's budget. So I would request that if you could do that and provide that to the committee.
And then also, for those that happened, maybe not were able to hear Senator Hoffman, he asked if the chart could be recalculated using the proposed oil bill that has been submitted from the governor, which basically changes, I think, the revenue stream by about $1 billion. But if you could calculate that sometime, then also it'd be nice to have 11 and 12 calculated, these same charts, with just the agency and the statewide operations as a total and the capital as a total, or maybe the capital even left out, so we can get a better view of where the operations of the state are relative to our revenue stream. Because as we know, the capital budget can go up or down.
We can do that, Mr. Chairman. Now, what you don't see on this chart and that you can see on the others, it should be somewhat alarming, is that I mentioned the $77 break-even point in 11 and an $83 break-even point in 12. And the key points from this chart is that an increase in spending shifts that expenditure line upward, and that declining oil production, lower tax rates, additional tax credits, or declining profitability shifts the revenue curve downward. And as we mentioned, that $1 change in oil prices produces a $100 million change in revenue. But that's movement along a curve. It's not shifting those curves around. And to tie this together, as the expenditure line shifts upward and the revenue curve shifts downward, or as the progressivity changes, that break-even price of oil rises rapidly, and your reserves can vanish just as quickly as they built up. So that's all easier to see if we combine the FY11 and FY12 charts on the same page. You can see the shifting and moving. But I'll walk through that. At point A, that uses the FY11 expenditures of $5.35 billion, and it uses the FY11 revenue curve. And you can see that break-even point is $77. Now, if the revenue curve stayed the same in 12 as it was in 11, and you spent $400 million more, and that $400 million is simply the upward shift in the expenditure line, the break-even price would be somewhere around $80 or $81. You can also see that if you had kept your expenditures the same but used the FY12 revenue curve, the blue line, that your break-even point would also be somewhere around the $80 range. That's not what happened. The expenditure line did shift up by about $400 million. The revenue curve shifted downward, and you don't go into that middle territory. You effectively shift down the revenue curve, or shift to a new revenue curve, and then walk along it all the way up to point D, where the break-even price is $83. So if that trend doesn't scare you, I don't know what will, because the revenue curve does shift downward over time, and expenditure curve does shift upward over time. We're going to need ever-increasing prices of oil to break even. So why does the revenue curve shift downward? And the answers there are production decline is the main driver. Typically, you would see a larger shift than we're seeing from 11 to 12. But the forecast for FY12 production is up 1% rather than down 4 to 6%. So we've got a smaller shift. But again, those production forecasts have historically been high. Department of Revenue forecasts of revenue have been quite accurate. But it's accurate because of two offsetting errors. They've overestimated production and underestimated price. They cancel and turn out that you've got a pretty accurate forecast. But as production declines, that curve shifts downward. As it shifts downward, you've got to have a higher price in order to break even. And, of course, taxes, both the rates. Lower rates will shift the revenue curve downward, and tax credits do the same thing. And here I should explain that there's two different kinds of tax credits. I think revenue went through this yesterday. But the tax credits, the transferable tax credits, are the ones that show up as expenditures. And that's that, you know, I'm not sure what revenue said. I unfortunately had to miss the meeting, but in FY11, the estimate for transferable tax credits was about $180 million. In September, they said, too low. We need another $250 million. So the FY11 estimate now is $430 million to pay these tax credits. That number for 12 is $400 million. They appear as expenditures because we have to appropriate the money to purchase those tax credits. They shift the expenditure line upward. What I'm talking about in shifting the revenue curve downward is the tax credits that we can't see, and that's the ones that are netted out of the tax return.
That's 23E. That's the main
23E and 20. Yeah. And of course, lower profitability. And here we have obviously profitability depends on price. But it depends on some other factors, too, capital expenditures, operating expenditures. And then this is a double whammy because as production declines, you have fewer barrels of oil to spread these higher costs over. So your cost per barrel is going up, meaning your profitability is hit very hard. So we tend to shift that curve downward rapidly over time. Expenditure curve shifts upward over time because of formula programs. It's primarily K-12 and Medicaid. And they both seem to take an increasing amount of money every year. Another issue is the incremental budget process. It's the process that you use to determine operating budgets. You simply review increments. If all you ever look at is increments, the budget has little choice but to go up. And until you look at the entire budget and begin removing existing programs instead of adding only increments, that curve will continue to shift up. You've got debt service and tax credits. Those are consequences of past legislation. When you issue hundreds of millions of dollars of GO bonds. You are then saddled with, well, this year, about $35 million more debt service expenditures every year for the next 20 years. And retirement costs is a big driver of this as well. I couldn't resist. I did put a slide in. It's a slight digression, but this is huge. As you know, retirement costs in FY11 were about $360 million, and I'm talking about the amount that the state contributes in excess of the rate that employers pay. So for PERS, the state is paying 22%. All employers are paying 22%. But the rate is closer to 40%, and the state directly contributes on the behalf of employers. That amount of money grew from $360 last year to $480 million this year. And you can see from this chart that that continues right up until it's over $1 billion in less than 10 years, and goes right up over to $1.4 billion before it begins to decline. You're now talking costs that are right in the neighborhood of Medicaid and K-12. So unless you can do something about the retirement system and the direct amount of direct contributions that the state's making, that expenditure curve is going to be shifting upward rapidly in the future.
Just for general information for the committee members, there is discussions going on very preliminarily with the administration, and then I've got to sit down with the deputy commissioner and then work with Ledge Finance, trying to come up with some methodology of cash flowing this so we don't walk ourselves into a billion plus in appropriations heading out 8 years from now, when we've got, you know, hypothetically maybe a volume in around where we're at or a little less on our oil production and all our other costs going up. So some, we've got a we will be working on that, and that'll be coming back at some point for further review of the committee and discussion. Go ahead, Mr. Teal.
So this really brings us to the fourth element that I had on my beginning slide, and that's a little bit longer-term view. FY12 looks good. The governor's budget's balanced. We've got a lot of reserves. And the question, of course, is what about next year and the year after that? Well, the governor may have a revenue plan. He wants to change the tax structure to encourage production. But that clearly is going to reduce revenue in the short term. And that's a guarantee. If you reduce taxes, you will shift that revenue curve downward. Now, the hope is that by changing the tax rates, you're going to encourage exploration, which leads to development and to production and to a shift upward sometime later. The questions for you are, will that long-term gain offset the short-term losses? And remembering that the short-term losses are guaranteed, the long-term gains are speculative. And second, do you have enough reserves to bridge the gap between point A and point B? And I don't know what the legislature is going to do about taxes or where price and production go. We simply look at the Department of Revenue forecast. We don't have much choice. It would get too confusing for the legislature and everyone else if we started talking about different production forecasts and different revenue forecasts. So we tend to focus on the appropriation side and simply use the Department of Revenue's numbers, both now and in the future. So we have a pretty simple model, which would allow us to do what you asked earlier, Mr. Chairman, and that is, well, what if growth, operating growth, is at 3%? What if we change that growth and so on? But first, you might look at history. and note that spending did not increase for a number of years, all of these years between basically the late 80s to the early 2000s. Expenditures were flat. I don't think it's any coincidence that it was flat because we didn't have any money. Revenue was flat during that period. So as FY5 came along, oil prices began going up, meaning revenue climbed rapidly, and revenue is this green shaded area, and the expenditures are the stacked bars, and as you can see, you've got agency operations and statewide operations, capital budget, and the transfers there. The appropriations increased just as rapidly as the revenue did. And given the Department of Revenue forecast for higher revenue, what we look at is there any reason to believe that appropriations are going to slow down, or will they continue to follow the revenue curve? So you can then focus on just the end of that chart. And instead of looking at the history, it's a little easier to see if you magnify it and go from 2007 and then out into the future. Here, you can see the prices of oil, Department of Revenue forecast, and they're going up to $100 and beyond. You can also see that production is not following their standard 6% decline. It's going from 616 in 11, 622, 642. So we've got a few years of increased production in their forecast before it turns around and begins to drop again. Here you were saying, well, can you run some different assumptions? Yes, we have a model that allows you to change these, but it gets into what if games that are fun to play. But you can also just look at the chart here without running those scenarios and say, what does this include? It's a capital budget flat at $500 million. We think that's reasonable because look at the history. $1 billion, 900, 800, 511, but that's not gone through the supplemental process yet. So 500 is a low to reasonable estimate of continuing capital budgets. Statewide operating, we simply took the $1.2 billion that we're spending now and which is difficult to reduce. It's the debt service. It's the oil tax credits, some large expenditures. And to that, we added the retirement cost going up to $1.4 billion way out in the future. And then we said, and what's agency growth? We use 7.6%. Why 7.6 when the Department of Revenue or the administration uses 3%? Because we went back and said, look at 06 to 11 and the growth between the two. That growth has been 7.6 overall. Now, this is pretty frightening data to me because you can see that two agencies, Health and Social Services and Education, although they didn't grow particularly rapidly compared to some other departments that are, you know, up in the 20s or even 30%, these have relatively low growth. But they're so large that they account for 28 and 24% of the entire growth. The other way of looking at this is Department of Health and Social Services and Education, the two departments account for just over half of the entire increase in the state operating budget. It's no coincidence that that's where Medicaid and K-12 formula programs are located. You can take that further and say the top five agencies account for 75%. And here you have corrections, for instance. If Goose Creek opens, that's $50 million a year annual operations. Now, there'll be some offsetting costs as you bring prisoners back from out of state, but generally, we don't see a reason for these costs to be a whole lot lower than they've been during the past 5 years. So, again, we use that 7.6% growth in the operating budget. And some people would look at this graph and say, no problem. We've got surpluses of $300 to $600 million a year all the way out to 2017. Things are great. Others might look at it and say, well, if oil prices don't continue to rise right through $100, if production doesn't meet expectations, if oil tax rates are reduced, or if expenditures turn out to be more difficult to control than 7.6, we start eating into those reserves very soon and very quickly. And here you're looking, for instance, at by 2020, a $1.5 billion deficit. So, again, in wrapping up, the fiscal situation is very strong for 12. It's a balanced budget, solid reserves. But what we're looking at is downward shifts in that revenue curve, upward shifts in the expenditure curve, retirement system, all adding up to a situation in which reserves can vanish just as quickly as they were built up.
Thanks, Mr. Field. But if we can back up to chart 25. That was page 25. That's 26. Back up one page. We look at some of your projections, and we had OMB in here the other day, yesterday, and they had some forward projections that were substantially different. Well, for instance, 3% growth rate versus your 7.6, which then affects our reserve positions and break-even points and all that stuff. Also, they didn't have obviously Medicare, the effect on that issue, and then the retirement fund. Have you spent any time trying to reconcile that projection yesterday that we had from them versus yours here for areas that we should take a look at, other than some of the obvious ones you just mentioned?
Mr. Chairman, we have not. What OMB was using was their 10-year projections. Their 10-year projections are for 3% because, essentially, those were the instructions. Increase your budget at 3%.
Instructions for who?
To the agencies. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically keeping pace with inflation.
Right. I guess my concern there is that there's a lot of dialogue within the press on growth numbers, which, in my opinion, give the impression to the public that the rate of change in our operating account is substantially different than it actually is, because they don't take into account statewide operations. And quite frankly, I find it misleading, my personal opinion, where the growth numbers here at 7.6, or if you want to back up and do 3 years or what have you, is a little more representative of what's been going on.
Mr. Chairman, that's why we chose the numbers, is because we simply took history, the last 5 years, and said, continue that trend. Now, here you can see that maybe that trend won't continue. There was a long period of time where we didn't have operating growth. We didn't have large capital budgets. They're just projections, and that's why I say, if you can control spending growth, then the future looks better. But historically, what's happened is when revenues are high, expenditures move right along with the available revenue.
So if I could maybe have you do this projection at 3%, and then plug in the impact of the retirement chart that you have, and then you're going to have to try to get some kind of a guesstimate in there for Medicare issues. My expectation is that we're going to come under substantial pressure within the agency agencies themselves, 3%, some of them would have to have substantial reductions. And if, I'd like that calculated and give us some idea of, you know, what type of impact we may see.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a model to do that. It's pretty simple, but I think, you know, you're not going to get a whole lot more information by adding complexity. So, but some people might say that you haven't taken everything into account. You know, you're oversimplifying. But the model, I think, does pretty much what you want it to do. It allows you to enter different growth rate assumptions for different pieces of the budget and allows you to essentially adjust the height of or the rate of growth in these bars.
Senator Hoffman?
On page 25, I think you're a little bit conservative, probably a lot conservative on from 2013 to 2020 on your yellow line. That seems considerably low, knowing the appetite of the legislature.
The question was the forward projection on the capital budget expenditures at $500 million is a conservative number that most likely we'd have a number higher than that. And in particular, if we look at doing any of our major projects, of course.
Mr. Chairman, I think your co-chair was gently prodding your known love of the capital budget.
Do we have any other questions for Mr. Teal? Well, thank you, Mr. Teal, for coming in today. If you could get back to the committee, we'll get those documents passed around and the other updated charts and stuff, and we'll go from there.
Mr. Chairman, would you like to review that Excel model in your office, or would you want it to come before the committee?
Well, I'd like to maybe take a look at it, and then we'll bring it before the committee so the committee members can get a feel for the sensitivity of what we're dealing with. Because I think last year we came forward with the shifting curves, or maybe 2 years ago, I forgot now, the shifting production curves and how that dramatically moves the break-even price. I think we all got a pretty good feel for that. But I would like to take a look at the forward projections on the expenditures. I think the information brought by you and your staff to the committee is more informative than OMB, not to take anything against OMB, but we've asked them to see if they can't, you know, put a little more data in their 35,000-foot model. I think at least get it to 30,000-foot. Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. Mr. Peel, as you look at page slide 22, you're talking about the retirement and the state assistance to the retirement system in terms of billions of dollars. You see that there's a significant drop-off on 2029. In fact, in 2032, the PERS goes to zero, and then in 2039, we have no more state assistance. What's the reason for that, and what will interfere? Okay, what's the reason for it, I guess, is the first question.
Through the chair, although some people dislike using the mortgage concept and the retirement concept as similar, I believe they're similar in the sense that retirement is a debt that you incur. It's the unfunded liability is something that needs to be paid off. However, it's a soft liability in the sense that there's no scheduled debt service payment for it. Nevertheless, the projections tell you this is what you're going to be paying for this many years. And what happens is that, like a mortgage, those huge borrowings that hit us in 2006, 7, and 8 and opened that unfunded liability gap are paid off in 25 years. So what you're seeing here is this huge drop is, if you recall the retirement system, it went along at basically 100% funding for years. And suddenly, we went from no gap to a $6 billion gap in 1 year. This drop is 25 years after that gap opened up, because that's the last mortgage payment, if you want to think of it that way, and now you don't have to be paying off that $6 billion. Then there are more small drops as the 2007, 2008, and 2009 liabilities went. Assuming, this chart assumes, that there is no further unfunded liability increases in 2010, and effectively we've paid off the loan.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
As you look at that chart, and the reason we got into the unfunded liability situation was because of inaccurate actuarials that were out there that obviously turned out to be unreliable. How, as you see this, how, what percentage of reliability do we have there? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, it's not merely a case of inaccurate actuarial assumptions that contributed. There were other factors that had much more impact. Those are health care costs, which were underestimated, but you could argue that that was an actuarial assumption error. The mortality rates, again, you can argue that that's an actuarial assumption error. They were using outdated tables. And when you use new tables that show people living longer, therefore collecting longer, then your liability goes up. But the major factor for that unfunded liability gap is investment losses. In fact, if you look at the recent performance of the ARM board, well, not the ARM board, but of the investment portfolio, there's a return projected of 8.25%. If we had earned 8.25%, we'd have over $4 billion more in the account than we have. So we've gone from the $6 billion unfunded liability to over 10, and some would say 12 if you're using market value. And again, the driver of those is investment losses. The actuarial assumptions have been changed. I think they're more accurately reflecting the current situation, and in fact the ARM board is currently reviewing all of its actuarial assumptions. They're probably going to change their investment projections, their inflation projections, and a number of other assumptions, including health care, all of which will change the amount of unfunded liability. And when you change your investment performance downward, that means that their investments don't earn as much, which means you increase your unfunded liability. So, if anything, I'd say this chart understates the severity of the situation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
And just as a quick note, we've encouraged the ARM board here at the table for the last several years to review that 8.25% target rate because it appeared to be too high, and they kept, well, they did what they, you know, they do what they do. But it appears that now that it's actually caught their attention and they're reviewing that number, and I would expect that number to be adjusted downward. We've been concerned for years here at the table of them not meeting their targets and that liability spreading. Any other questions for Mr. Teel? Thank you, Mr. Teel. Tomorrow there will be no meeting. We'll be posting later today the schedule for next week. Meeting adjourned.